You're listening to the Hello World podcast, number 75. My name is Sean Wildermuth, and I'm your host. The Hello World podcast is where you can hear from some of your favorite developers, authors, and speakers about how they got started in this business and the decisions they made along the way. We go way back to their first computer, their first code experience, and their first job. We've decided not to have a sponsor for the podcast, but if you would like to support the podcast and the kinds of things that I do, feel free to visit my Pluralsight courses at seanw.me/psauthor, including my newest course on building a web app with ASP.NET Core. During the road trip, I had the pleasure of interviewing Brian Friesen while we were in Detroit. Brian has been pretending to be a developer for the last 9 years and lives in constant fear of being found out. He suspects that someone has been bribing Microsoft on his behalf, as he has received the C# MVP award the last 3 years. His presentations always involve live coding, and he prefers topics that don't get much attention. He lives near Detroit and works for an awesome company, Quicken Loans. I like Brian's story so much because he has a lot of passion. And even though he's been working in the same place for a little while now, he knows how lucky he is to be a software developer. That journey started young for him, but he still has that same passion he's had for his whole career. Let's take a listen. Well, welcome, Detroit. Wow, that's exciting. I have never been to Detroit before. Today on our show, we have Brian Friesen, which I'm really happy to see him here.
Hello.
And, you know, the this is our, I think, 21st stop. 21st or 22nd? 21st stop on this trip. And Detroit has been sort of interesting. It's a mix. It's not anything like I thought it was. We're on the 19th floor of the Microsoft office, and I think I can see Ohio from here. It is really flat.
Yeah, I never knew that about it. Those hills over here are where I live.
Oh, really?
Those are actually hills.
I don't think those are hills. I really
they
don't
are,
think
I promise.
They're hills. So, Brian, you work for Quicken Loans now. You work with some other people that we've had on the podcast.
Yes, I do.
And some other people whose audio we have lost and will record later that was on the podcast. How did you get started? Did you have a computer growing up?
Yeah, I've had a computer since I can remember. My dad was actually a developer.
Oh, really?
He was. And when I was 3 or 4, this being like 81 or 82, he bought an 8086 is what it was.
Wow.
With a 20 megabyte hard drive and 64K of RAM.
20 megabyte hard drive.
He paid a lot of money for that.
That alone, for the hard drive, the first hard drive I had was, I guess, in 87. The company I worked for had, and it was 5 megabytes and literally enormous. It was a foot high and like 6 inches thick. It's crazy.
Like $4,000 for the computer.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And but you did get a whole 64K RAM?
Yeah, all 64.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, CGA monitor.
And did you play games on it?
Yeah, I played games on it. I remember being real little, like 6 or 7, we played a game called In Search of the Most Amazing Thing. Have you heard of that one?
I have not.
You haven't. So my dad hacked the save game file for us and nice. Find out and changed the value of how much money you had in the game. And the game adjusted, so everything got more expensive when he did that.
Oh, really? Wow.
It was horrible. I thought we were going to be able to cheat, and we totally couldn't.
A smarter developer than others. I remember playing Telengard. I don't know if anyone remembers Telengard, but it was written in BASIC, I think. And it was like a D&D adventure sort of game. You'd have these dungeons to go through, you know, using slashes. And I think the character was an asterisk, but we just made because I had been playing Dungeons and Dragons, it was sort of based on those rules. I would go in and I'd edit the save files so that I had 18 in everything. Well, of course, the game engine didn't care what value I put in there. They were just computing them. But because I'd played D&D, 18 was the max value in D&D. And I didn't have the imagination to think what would happen if I did 19, right? It didn't even occur to me.
Never tried.
So you had an early PC, and did you play any programming with it? Did you get into BASIC or at all?
I didn't really get into programming. My dad tried to get me into programming when I was like middle school, high school. I didn't really want to have anything to do with it at the time.
Probably because he did it.
Right. Probably because he did. And yeah. Right. But it was really interesting. So we had pretty much all of the x86 models, right?
Nice.
I still have a Gateway 2000 486 that I use as an end table.
Wow.
It's a tower. It stands about 3 feet tall. It weighs like 40 pounds. It's pretty awesome. But in between middle school and high school, my dad was laid off from his job and my parents bought a campground in Western New York.
Oh, wow. And where did you grow up before this?
Suburban Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Right. So he worked for Quill Corporation for like 20 years.
Wow.
And they laid him off after he made them millions of dollars in marketing and all sorts of stuff. He was probably the best developer there. But so my parents bought a campground. And the first summer we had the campground, it was so painful because the reservation book was a book.
A physical book.
Wow. And penciling in people. And I remember answering the phone. It was just awful. So my dad spent the entire winter that first year writing a campground management system in COBOL. Yeah. And this was 92, 93. And this was my first experience watching an actual application, a system develop. And he used to call me in and ask me questions on, you know, what if it looks like this? Should it look like that? How about this function? And he would show me some of the code, and I was mildly interested.
Sure.
And I would watch and see what he was doing. And that was pretty cool. And my great idea of that program was put a screensaver in. There was a little campground A-frame dancing around the screen.
That's funny.
And but that was my my first coding experience, I guess you could say.
Nice.
So that was the beginning of high school. But my first code that I actually wrote was on a TI-81 calculator.
Oh, nice.
I learned to program by reading the manual.
And that is the last manual you've ever read?
No, I'm one of those weird guys. I read the manual. First thing I do is read the instructions. What are you supposed to do with this thing?
It's like an albino elephant. I didn't think it really existed. Wow, a developer that reads the manual.
Right, so I read the manual. I couldn't figure out what a for loop is for because we had a while loop and the syntax and the TI-86 or TI-81 BASIC was really weird. So for loops are just weird. But so the first thing I wrote that was useful to me was a sort of a magic 8-ball program.
Nice.
You would type in letters into it, and I had assigned each of those letters, they were variables in the calculator.
Sure.
So you'd say, is it a who, what, where, why, or when question? So each one of those letters, I would multiply them together and do a whole bunch of random operations on them, and then take the decimal part, and if it was greater or less than 0.1, it would be one value. If it was less than 0.2, it was another value. And I used to change the values. I would give it to girls that I was trying to flirt with.
There's nothing like flirting with the software you wrote for your calculator.
Yes, indeed.
Wow. Is that how you met your wife?
No.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, so that was fun. And, I would try to make the answers risque or put myself in the answer if I could figure out what the question was that she was typing. So that was the first useful thing for me that I ever wrote.
And was this in high school or college?
Yeah, high school. This would have been 10th grade, 11th grade, something like that.
Nice.
And remember my calculus teacher, to try to get me to pass the class because I didn't do my homework ever in order to get me to pass a class, because I always did really well in the test, but my homework brought my grade down. I used to tutor her students on how to use their calculators better, how to program them, how to do that sort of thing.
And just so we're clear, kids, stay in school.
Yes, okay. Stay in school. And then after high school, I promptly forgot all about that stuff and kind of went off and did my own thing for about 5 or 6 years.
Nice. Then, you had mentioned that you used to deliver pizzas.
Yes.
Was this during that period?
I had all of the jobs during that period. I worked in a factory, a gas station, and a hotel doing landscaping.
Nice.
Fast food. Worked at Ruby Tuesdays. I had all of the jobs. So where I am not right now, I recognize how privileged I am.
Oh, good.
So
That can be a rarity sometimes.
Yeah. So I didn't have everything handed to me. It was interesting to have that sort of experience. Pizza delivery was one of those jobs. So when I've been married for about 6 months or so. I was about 23, 24 in there. I'd gotten a postcard from ITT.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I wasn't completely sober, and I filled out this postcard. And I said, you know, I thought back to the campground system that my dad had written and the silly calculator program that I'd written. I was like, yeah, that might be kind of fun.
Sure.
So I mailed in the postcard and probably forgot all about it until I got a call a few weeks later. And
sure.
Ended up going to school and got my associate's degree about 2004.
Nice.
And took 2.5 years to find the first job. There's a lot of pizza delivery in there.
Oh, wow.
So it's...
When you were in... at ITT, were they teaching at all software development or IT?
It was for software development. Had a lot of project management classes, which actually came in handy.
Sure.
So we learned all sorts of project management techniques, you know, Gantt charts, all Microsoft Project and all
those. So you learned how that developers are liars. Is that effectively what you... isn't that project management?
Yeah, make up the numbers and...
Yeah.
And retroactively make them fit later, right? Something like that.
Cut features until it fits, yeah.
Right. So I went to ITT, did programming, learned Visual Basic, C++, and Java.
Nice.
In there. So the first thing I wrote in a real programming language was a Mandelbrot fractal generator in VB6.
Nice.
It was pretty cool because my calculus teacher loved fractals, so I gave her a copy of the program on a floppy disk. you could explore all the fractal and zoom in, zoom out, and, nice. And take screenshots. And
that's awesome.
And yeah, it was a fun little program. And then I ported it to VB.net, and then I ported that to C#, and I played with interfaces and made the coloring scheme all customizable. Fun stuff
that's
like
cool.
that. And learned about loop unrolling because it's a pretty intensive algorithm to calculate the Mandelbrot set.
Right.
So I would unroll the loop. And I did some performance testing and found out, I think it was like 6 or 7 unrolls per iteration was optimal. And I got some good performance boosts out of that.
Nice. And so during this time that you're starting to write code, is this when, did you realize how much you were going to enjoy it? Did you kind of get that bug that some developers get?
Oh, yeah. I got the bug right away in school. I mean, I'd done it in high school, and that was just kind of screwing around. But I remember our capstone project for our associate's degree. You're supposed to write some sort of like financial management system, kind of like really old Microsoft Money or Quicken, something like that. And I took it upon myself. We are going to write the best damn capstone project they ever saw, and I must have put like 300 or 400 hours into this thing.
Wow.
And it was before I knew about version control, so we were on a team and we were emailing files back and forth, and we lost entire versions. And
wow,
yeah, that was good times.
Keep a floppy of every is that not how people still do version control? Am I wrong?
Yeah,
about?
Just make a copy of the whole directory.
Every time I do a check into GitHub, they don't copy it onto a floppy and put it someplace?
They should if they don't. They're not. Yeah, I'm worried. We need to call GitHub.
We do.
Actually, at the time, I had a USB drive. It was so great. It was 64 megabytes.
Wow.
Right. I paid like $50 for this thing. It was like, I could not believe how many floppies worth of data I could fit on this thumb drive. I was like in school. I was like, yes, I can. I don't need to carry around floppies anymore. Take that, everybody else that doesn't have one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you brought your viruses everywhere. That's
I sure did.
It's very convenient.
Yes. And the, we won't get too much into the most evil thing I ever wrote. So this
well,
was,
you brought it up.
I sure did. So I once wrote an application. I think it was in C#. It would maximize itself to the full size of all of your monitors. It was transparent and borderless and topmost. So you know the old trick where you take a screenshot of somebody's desktop and then you hide all their icons and then you put it on there. This was like that, except worse, because their actual desktop was there.
Right.
If they hit the Windows key, it would actually bring up the Windows menu. You could actually open an application, but it would be underneath. Oh, and of course I had to cancel the closing event. So if they hit Alt F4, it would cancel that. So it was hard to develop that because I locked myself out of my own machine a couple of times.
How do you test it? You have a friend.
Yes, here, run this. And I always wanted to put it into somebody's startup menu, but I never did. I really wanted to do that. That would just be the meanest thing.
It would be. Wow. That is a... You're telling me more about you than I think you want anyone to know.
Yeah, you can cut that, right?
No. Once it's committed to tape, it's there. It is there. So you said it took about 2.5 years to get that first job. Mm-hmm. What was that first job like?
The first job was actually really awesome. I completely lucked out. It was one of my instructors. He basically manufactured the job for me.
Oh, nice.
So I had gone back to ITT to get my bachelor's. I dropped out and then I got my bachelor's later. But he was an adjunct instructor there, and I had some database class for him. And he's like, "You still don't have a job?" Because I'd had him when I got my associate's.
Sure.
And so it took probably about 6 months, but he basically made a position and found a way for the company to hire me.
Nice.
It's a company called NukeSafe. We made radiation detection equipment.
Wow.
So really, really cool science stuff.
And luckily, you know, software bugs weren't going to cause anything egregious to happen in a company.
No, we
like
were just
that.
Detecting the nuclear radiation.
Okay.
We weren't making any, although we had a lot of sources in the building. Like one guy went on eBay and bought all of the radium watch dials that he could.
Wow.
And put them in a little plastic case, and we use that as a source to go through the detectors.
Wow.
Right? And he used to keep it in his office behind lead bricks. So he could go in his office, pick up the radium. There it is.
Oh, wow. That does not sound safe.
It wasn't that high of a dosage. So you had to be trained. You had to be certified in order to work there. And some people carried around dosimeters. I was not certified to handle sources. I was certified to stay away from the sources.
Oh, okay. So you had to go through a class where they said, don't go near the radiation.
Yes, and you learned about the inverse square law. So you'd see people walking down the hall with these big 3-foot tongs with a hot source on the end of it. And they'd just be walking down the hall because it's got enough distance.
Right.
Not that much material there, and that you're perfectly safe.
I have to tell you, I'm not sure I would feel perfectly safe.
Yeah. Well, but I look at my kids now and, maybe we shouldn't have done that.
You're not supposed to keep them in your pockets, is all.
No, you absolutely were not supposed to keep the source in your pocket. It was specifically in the training that you not do that.
That's funny. And were you doing like C# and .NET? Or?
Yeah, we were doing C#. So there was a big debate right when I started if we were going to go to VB.NET or C#.
Sure.
Right. And the existing statistical engine was written in VB6, which is kind of amazing because it connected to 16, 20, 24 different sensors.
Wow.
And in VB6 being a single threaded environment, they had to do all sorts of hacks in order to get that to work. The stuff that I worked on a diagnostic utility. I worked on front end WinForms applications. So the security guards or the people at customs would be running my application, and it would alert them if there was a source or something like that.
How did you, since this was your first job, what was the experience like? Was it what you expected a job in software development was going to be? I mean, expectations in school are one thing, and then you get into a job and...
I don't know if what expectations I had. I don't know. Didn't really have any.
Sure.
It was, I remember being terrified to change code for 6 months. Mm. Right. And this is just our a diagnostics and a utility for service technicians to use. So it wasn't like, you know, going to break
customer
anything.
Facing.
Right. It wasn't anything, right. So. But I was so scared of making changes. But I was lucky enough to be to have some coworkers who were really good and patient. I had a really great mentor, Mark McKnight,
nice.
who really guided me and shielded me from management a lot of the times, and gave me room to explore and figure out how to do things.
And when you say he sort of guided you, you're talking about in code or in dealing with the environment, politics? I mean,
both of those.
Really?
Right. So there was a fair amount of politics in the company. We used to get into arguments on the best way to do things. He had 15 years of experience at the time. So,
sure.
So, but it was really interesting. Usually we would be arguing and fighting, and we would usually both end up being right. We were just arguing a slightly different point.
Sure. I think that's most of the reason that software companies have meeting rooms, right?
Right.
So that people can discuss the minutia, because they usually agree on most of it.
Right.
And did you expect that you were going to need to learn as much about the domain of the company you were working in than you were? I mean, certainly part of it is I know what a for loop and I know how to do an if, mm-hmm. or I knew how to draw a window on the screen. But there's this other part of the job that, at least for me, wasn't obvious when I started in software that was going to be a big part of my job.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I suppose it was. I mean, I enjoyed science in high school, and I remembered a lot of the stuff from physics and that sort of thing. Where I was, it was not so much in the domain. It was a lot of front facing stuff, right? So we got to display the counts. We got to you know, show the user what they need, make sure that it's usable, not too many clicks in order to get things done. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't in the nitty gritty details. I didn't ever work on the statistical engine.
Sure.
So I wasn't talking to the scientists at the company all that much.
Mm, interesting. And, how long did you stay there?
I was there for about 4 years.
And what prompted you to move on?
Well, they laid off Mark, and that kind of, it pissed me off, broke my heart.
Sure.
I mean, it wasn't the same without him there. And
let me be clear. I'm not asking you to say mm-hmm. things about that.
Right.
Or certainly say things about where you were to work, but just the... I found that a lot of people in software that move to their first new job ever, you know, from their first job is usually harder than they might imagine.
It was hard. I mean, it was, I guess you could say, made easier by them laying Mark off.
Sure.
Right.
That sort of pushed you in that direction.
Yeah, it kind of pushed me. And I had several jobs after that. A few too many, too quickly.
I think we've all gone through a little
yes.
of that.
Yes, and in the last job before Quicken Loans, I said I'm going to stay at Quicken Loans for 2 years because I'd had four jobs, including the first one before that.
Nice.
In the span of about 2 years.
And how long have you been at Quicken Loans now?
A little over 4 years.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And so with a company like Quicken Loans, did you grow into more than the sort of software developer you thought you were when you got started? Or, I mean, what?
I had kind of been working, sort of not planned, but working towards a mindset of quality and looking forward. At mm-hmm. NukeSafe, we had a guy named Bill who was notorious for selling systems that didn't exist yet. And
so you mean you had a sales staff?
He was definitely in sales. The problem was he was also a nuclear physicist. So when he said that something was possible, he was right. Except that didn't account for the UI work and the database work and all the communication and,
sure,
and getting everything set. So the first time I got bit by Bill, I vowed to make the next thing I wrote Bill proof. So I started getting into coding to interfaces and making sure that things were swappable. And nice. Is where I started learning about quality. Around that same time, I went to my first CodeMash, and I went to the CodeMash pre-compiler software craftsmanship.
Nice.
With Steve Smith and Brendan Elric.
Yeah, yeah. Steve's right? Great.
And I learned what TDD looked like, what it felt like, what quality looked like. And so I was like, yeah, this is what I need. This is where I need to go. And so I started really focusing on that sort of thing. I started going to my local .NET user group in East Tennessee at the time. Mm-hmm. I did my first talk there about coroutines in C# is basically what async and await does.
Sure.
But with yield return,
right,
and a special interface.
Before async and await.
Before
probably.
Async and await, right? So re-entering functions. It was really, really super nerdy. And and I had code samples and I was typing up there, and it was super duper fun. I also, from talking with Steve and Brendan, they're involved, or at least were involved, with the Hudson Craftsmanship Group in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I went there one time on the way from Knoxville to Western New York, where my parents lived. And I was like, this, yes, I want to do that. So I started a user group in Knoxville, the Knoxville Craftsmanship Group.
Nice.
So we did code katas. We, you know, did a series on the solid principles and
sure.
got really into code quality and all that sort of thing. And so I had sort of organically grown into trying to write the best code that can possibly be done, making sure that it's build proof, that it can be changed and modifiable. And that's kind of where I've focused in on Quicken Loans. I'm on the core team at Quicken Loans, and we maintain an internal library that pretty much every .NET application uses inside of there. So,
nice.
So I'm a library author and maintainer, and making sure that things are easily changeable, injectable, testable, making sure that my code doesn't prevent your application from being tested,
or
focusing
versa,
on all
yeah.
those sorts of things.
So let's go back to when you took the TDD course mm-hmm. at CodeMesh. When you came back from that, was there opposition where you worked at sort of changing the way you did your job, or were you sort of more self-starter so you could make that change yourself?
It was more self-starter. I started getting into it, starting writing unit tests in my
sure.
day-to-day. Certain things are not as testable as others, especially if they weren't designed to be
sure.
testable. But I started doing that at the job after NukeSafe. I still keep in contact with my boss from there.
Nice.
You know, got him into Solid, got him into testability and coding to interfaces and things like that.
And how big is the audience at Quicken Loans of the libraries you guys are writing?
We have hundreds of applications.
Wow.
Yeah. So several hundred .NET developers.
So really you have to produce that like almost a product because you have enough customers that,
right.
And so does that mean you get involved in documentation and mm-hmm. examples and all that other
yep. documentation,
sort of
also support, you know, people ping us on our internal chat system.
Sure.
Hey, you need some help with your library. I got really anal retentive a couple jobs back. I turned on StyleCop in Visual Studio to the maximum settings. So I ran like 9 months documenting everything.
Sure.
And having code samples and all sorts of stuff like that.
Nice. And so where you're at now, are you managing a group?
No.
Okay.
Nope. So I take a lesson from my dad. He got into management. So I've said no management, no leadership for me. I will stay away from that if at all possible.
And what about that decision? I mean, I know you said you learned from your dad, but what did you learn about that from your dad? What is important to you to not go down that road?
Keeping myself in the code, that's that's what I like. That's what I love. At the end of the day, you know, I've written something, I've solved some problem. I just get off on that. I love it.
Sure.
It's what I love to do. And if I can't code, I quit.
So when they want to get rid of you, that's
right.
The
they'll
trick.
Go ahead and promote me to leadership, and right, they don't even have to worry about laying me off or firing me. Just
that's funny. So in your day-to-day job, I was always curious about this because I've done certainly customer-facing code and sort of deeply nested core stuff inside companies before, and. How do you get sort of the satisfaction of knowing who you're actually, you know, dealing with? How do you get requirements for things that are that hidden from the edge of the application? You can't go to users and go, what do you want in logging
right.
in error conditions, right?
Right. Well, it comes from the developers. Mm-hmm. They need a new feature, or as a company, we need to go in this direction.
Sure.
You know, some big features, some of them are just little quick hits. Hey, it needs to do this one little thing. And you go and you find that spot in the code and take a scalpel and you just tweak it just a little bit mm-hmm. and you get them their feature and nobody else notices that there's anything in there, but they're
sure.
happy at the end of the day.
Sure.
So my clients are the other developers.
And how do you handle versioning since you have so many, you said hundreds or 100 maybe applications?
We have an internal NuGet server.
Oh, okay.
So we just publish it on our internal NuGet server and grab the version that you want.
And so that as people build, they might be working with older mm-hmm. or edge versions.
Yep.
And
so nice. Supporting versions going back a couple of years before I was even at the company.
Nice. And so you weren't involved in the decision to use the internal NuGet server?
No, it was done before I got there.
Interesting. And have you had any trouble with that?
Not really. It works pretty smoothly. There are other teams that are also using our internal NuGet server. They use it in different ways. Also involved in, we have open sourced our internal set of libraries.
Nice.
We're in the process of renaming them because it's a collision with our internal name and the public name, and
yeah.
we should never have named it that.
Sure. That's funny.
So it's, as of last Friday, it's to be called Rocklib.
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 Wow.
It was, Quicken Loans was originally Rock Financial, so there's a lot of rock things in the company.
That's funny. You should never put your company name in the product name, by the way. So everyone starting a company right now that is listening to this podcast, don't do it. It's just a vanity project at that point. I've run into this more times than you know, unless it's your blog, then you can call it, because that's what I've done. So I can, so I'm going to stand on that decision. So during your, you know, the last few years of development, you know, you primarily been in a .NET shop. Have mm-hmm. you looked at other languages or other technologies that maybe you can't use in your day job yet, but that are the things that are exciting you?
The Erlang stack is pretty interesting. Mm. We have some people on our team that are using Erlang and Elixir for some internal applications.
Interesting.
I've been in pretty much .NET. I've played with Erlang. I've played with a bunch of other languages. But I find .NET is able to do the things that I need.
Mm-hmm.
And being about a half .NET shop.
Sure.
All right. And with enough internal clients, I've got more than enough work to keep me busy.
And it's a comfortable place.
Yeah.
Awesome.
It's a super place. We're named Computer World's number one place to work in IT for the fourth year in a row.
Wow.
Been on the list every year for 12 years, I think.
Wow.
So
that's an impressive stat.
Yeah. So it's a super great place to work. I haven't considered leaving, which is good considering the previous places didn't last too long.
And I know some of the people you work with, so I'm
yeah.
really surprised that you're not leaving, to be perfectly honest with you. Well, this has been absolutely great. I appreciate you being on the show.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's give him a big hand.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Hello World podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to the Hello World podcast at hwpod.com.